The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. We're excited to have Annette Gordon Reed back with us tonight to discuss her new book, On Juneteenth. She first joined us in 2008, a couple of weeks after the publication of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, which went on to win both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. She was also here for her biography of Andrew Johnson, and later she shared the stage with Peter S. Onuf for their co-authored work, Most Blessed of the Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. Gordon Reed is currently the Carl M. Loeb University Professor at Harvard University, and her honors include the National Humanities Medal, a MacArthur Genius Grant, and the Frederick Douglass Prize. In her new book, the Texas-born historian examines her own past vis-a-vis her Lone Star State roots. In a shimmering review in the New York Times, Jennifer Zelai praised the book for the author's ability to combine clarity with subtlety, questioning her own assumptions, and showing that historical understanding is a process, not an endpoint. Tonight, Annette Gordon Reed will be in conversation with award-winning broadcaster, journalist, and longtime friend of the author event series, Tracy Matisak. It's great to have you with us tonight. The screen is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Andy, and it is quite an honor to be here tonight with Professor Annette Gordon Reed. As Andy mentioned, this book has gotten rave reviews. If you have not yet picked it up, make sure that you do that, and you can get it through the Joseph Fox Bookshop. But we are delighted to have this time together, and we would encourage you, as Andy said, to jot down some questions, because we've budgeted some time for your questions toward the end of the evening as well. So that said, Professor Annette Gordon Reed, welcome back to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
I'm very glad to be here. It's one of my favorite places. Wish I could be there in person, but alas, here we are.
Well, next time, when the next book comes out, hopefully we'll be in a place where we can do that. Yeah. The book, as Andy mentioned, is called On Juneteenth, and it is a collection of essays. And of course, Texas figures prominently all throughout the book. You are a native Texan, as he mentioned, and you open the book by talking about Texas exceptionalism, that everything in Texas is larger than life, and that people who are from there have a certain pride in being from Texas. But you also say that the image of Texas has a gender and a race, that Texas is a white man. What do you mean by that?
I think when people think about Texas, they think about a cowboy. They think about West Texas and cowboys and cattle and herds and so forth. And it's not about the part of Texas that was, you know, that had was a slave society, where you had African-American people, where you had plantation slavery. And this notion of the sort of rough and ready free individual would be a white man, because women don't have that kind of freedom, and Black people are not seen as having that kind of freedom. So Texas embody, the white male sort of embodies the way people see the image of Texas as the embodiment of a guy and a white guy. And so the book is trying to figure out, what does that mean for people who are Texans, as much Texans as anybody, who are not white guys? And so that's what I explore in the book.
I'd love for you to talk about the East Texas side of things, because to your point, when we think of Texas, we do think of the cowboy, the ranger, the oil man, we think of the West. Mm-hmm. But you make the point that it's the East, where Stephen Austin came and brought many settlers and wanted to, you know, make sure that slavery was accepted there. Can you elaborate on that and unpack it for us a little bit about that history of East Texas, and also the problems that can occur with selective memory and origin stories?
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen F. Austin, who is considered to be the father of Texas, as you said, brought settlers there. He was given the right to make a settlement there in Texas. And the settlers would be people who would come from other parts of the South, Georgia and Alabama, coming west, part of westward expansion. And they brought enslaved people with them. They thought that that would be part of the basis of their society. And so they were very, very wary about any kind of encroachment upon those rights. Austin was considered to be anti-slavery. He considered himself anti-slavery, not so much because he thought it was bad, but because he wasn't, you know, he didn't like the idea. There was a concern about the idea of Blacks and whites in society, too many Blacks in society. So he wasn't like a gung-ho on the institution, but he knew that it would be something that the people coming to the state would want to have in place. Someone had to clear the land, someone had to plant the crops, and it was great land for farming. Galveston was a port where things could be shipped out. So there is this legacy of slavery that people think of mainly in terms of Louisiana or Alabama and Mississippi, but not in Georgia, but not Texas. We think about the cowboy. Even people in East Texas claim there were cowboys in East Texas as well, but the real prototypical cowboy is part of the Western tradition. And people think of Texas as the West. They don't think of it as the South, but it was in the Confederacy. So, and it had plantations. So it was part of the South.
And it speaks to origin stories, right? And the stories that we tell ourselves mm-hmm. about where we came from and how we started. And there's a strong tendency in and out of Texas to have sort of a selective memory about those things.
Well, we all do that. We do that in our lives. We cut out the parts that are painful and, you know, become nostalgic for childhood that is perfect. But when you're in it, it may not have been as you're a teenager or whatever, but you know, we look at these things through rose-colored glasses, and we tend to do that as a nation, and we do that as Texans as well. We focus in on the heroic aspect of it. Remember the Alamo, the fight against Mexico, but not thinking about what was implicated in some of the, you know, in the conflict, what drove the conflict in many, many ways. And we want to think of ourselves, want to think of the past in heroic terms, but it's not always a wise thing to do. We could say never wise things to do, because you have to have, I think, a realistic picture of the past if you want to try to understand why we are in a particular position today, because all of those things, all of those influence led up to where we are now. And there are always going to be connections to the past. So we should try to be, I understand, I say in the book that, you know, we humans seem to need to have mythology and, you know, fond memories, but we really do have to be hard with ourselves in some ways and be realistic about the situations in the past.
Yeah. And it's one of the many ways in which, as you write, Texas is kind of a microcosm of America.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I say that all the sort of major currents of American history flow through Texas. There is the issue of plantation slavery, westward expansion, the conflict with indigenous people and the displacement of indigenous people, the conflicts and relationships between Hispanic culture and Anglo culture, Jim Crow after the end of slavery, all of those things, and it's a state that borders another country. It's so the international aspect of it is brought to bear in that particular place. So there's no other state that combines all of those kinds of things. And I think it really contributes to the kind of craziness of Texas in a lot of ways, because so much is going on there and has been going on there from the very, very beginning.
So the book, of course, is titled On Juneteenth, and it's really a collection of essays written by a native Texan about Texas and, of course, the United States, Texas's history and its resemblance to and reflection of, if you will, the larger United States. But the events of June 19th, 1865, which was Juneteenth, really only occupy a small portion of the book. It's almost as if Juneteenth is the hub from which all the spokes extend. And you could read the book and say, well, gee, it's not really that much about Juneteenth. Or you could read the book and say, it's all about Juneteenth, that it's all through the book. So why did you choose Juneteenth as sort of the peg on which to hang the rest of the book?
Well, because it's a day that commemorates the end of slavery in Texas. And there's so much packed into that notion, the effects of slavery on the state and on the country as a whole, the notion of race relations. Slavery helped, racially based slavery helped maintain and support and give a justification for white supremacy. And by talking about this particular day on Juneteenth means, in the book, in the chapters, I talk about what actually happened on that day and what the response was to it. But on Juneteenth also means the symbolism of it, the sort of substance of this moment when slavery ended, that slavery had to be ended. The fact that it existed is telling, and what it meant for the community and the people around them. So it's an opportunity for me to talk about my family story, talk about the history of Texas through thinking about how did we come to the point where Juneteenth was necessary and what happened after that, the aftermath of all of this. And so slavery and race and politics, all of those things are tied up in this particular day. So it is a way to talk about, it's a door to open a discussion about history, about Texas, the United States, its place in the United States, but also my family, something that I don't typically talk about. As a historian, I'm talking about other people's families. So I did something a little bit different with this and dipped my toe into memoir and melded it with history.
I smiled when I read that you felt some kind of way when Juneteenth became, it kind of captured the national imagination in more recent years. And there was a point at which you felt a degree of resentment about that as a Texan. Tell us about that.
Well, at the beginning, when I was away in college and I began to realize that there were other people and other places that were claiming Juneteenth, I had a very possessive view about it. I mean, that was not the way to go. I've gotten totally over that now, what everybody was celebrated now. But I thought this was something that made Texas unique. And when you grow up in Texas, there's a lot of emphasis on we are unique, we are different. And so this was something that belonged, I thought, particularly to Black Texans, because it wasn't until 79, I guess it became official in 1980, when I was still in college then, it became a state holiday. So before then, it was mainly Black people that I knew of in my little town. It could have been other places, but it was mainly Black people who celebrated. But at some point in the 70s, and then when it becomes a state holiday, Black and white people and Hispanic people of different cultures, everybody in Texas, became a Texas thing. So I was very possessive about that. But as I said, I've sort of moved on from that now.
And you're over it now.
I'm over it now. I'm
sharing it
now
with the rest of the country. Yeah, yeah. How did your family celebrate Juneteenth?
Well, it was sort of, this was of the run up to July 4th. So some things were similar. Barbecuing, firecrackers, red soda water. Red meaning pop, soda water. We called it soda water in those days. And before everything became a Coke, and then everything, every drink is a Coke. Barbecue goat for some reason was a part of the menu, although my family didn't partake of that, but that was another tradition that was there. And I'm told strawberry pie, which we didn't do, but the notion, I'd read this and I don't know if this is apocryphal or how ideas about how traditions come to bear can come from real places and not, but the thinking was that the red was about the blood that had been shed during slavery. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a symbolic connection to that. Mm-hmm. So it was just to think 4th of July with Black people and firecrackers. I was just thinking the other day that we had firecrackers when I was a kid. I was below 10. I can't imagine letting my kids play with firecrackers, but it was a different time. So it was a festive thing. It was summer, so we were not in school, but sometimes people took the day off. And it was a lot of running around and playing, and it was just a festive time. And then waiting for July 4th, which we celebrated as well. Hmm.
So your family goes way back in Texas. I mean, mm-hmm. generations. You said that on maybe it was your mom's side, it was to the 1820s, and your dad's at least 1860, and you had ancestors who were enslaved. And I'm curious how your older relatives talked about Juneteenth and were those stories passed down through the family?
Mm-hmm. Well, they sell, my great grandmother was alive until I was about 11 years old. And it's one of those things historians, you know, I could just kick myself for not talking to her. And she would try to, you know, older people tell you these stories and you go, yeah, I don't want to hear that. I would give anything to be able to ask her more about this. But I tell this story in a piece that I did for The New Yorker. One year I mentioned to my great grandmother, we were sitting on the porch and I said, it didn't seem to me as if people were taking Juneteenth seriously, that acting as if it didn't make any difference to us. And she said, it made a difference to us. It was important to us. And from that moment, I could, from the depth of her feelings, I knew that she really meant it. Her mother had been enslaved as a little girl and had been freed by her father along with her mother. And so she knew somebody who had been enslaved. And her mother had three husbands, all of them died. And the third one actually had not been freed until after the Civil War. So slavery was like a generation to them. It was just one, you know, removed from that. And I knew somebody who knew people who were enslaved. And wow. So this meant something. We knew that it didn't mean that everything was okay. My father, who could be really sarcastic, would say, oh, the slaves haven't been freed yet. But what he meant really was there was a long way to go in terms of civil rights and towards equal citizenship for Black people. But for me, it was a commemoration or thinking about the joy that those people must have felt knowing that legalized slavery was over. I mean, they knew it wasn't going to be perfect immediately, but not to have your children sold, not to have your family separated, other than in ways that people lose relatives to death and things like that, but not through sale or inheritance, through the laws of property, meant a great deal to those people. And so I think that's why the day means something to me. It's not saying everything was okay. It's that it's the recognition of what must have been their joy.
Yeah. And of course, very, very difficult times followed that. I mean, you had Juneteenth and you had the 13th Amendment, which officially ended slavery. And then you had Reconstruction. And then Reconstruction ultimately gives way to Jim Crow. And of course, Black people just, you know, to use the phrase, catching hell all over again in America. And it was just as true in Texas as it was anywhere in the country. You did not have to go much farther than your own hometown to find some really chilling examples of the ways in which Black people were treated during Jim Crow times, right there in Texas. And I was particularly struck by the story of Bob White. Can you tell us a little bit about his story?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. Bob White, I first learned about Bob White as a little girl because my grandfather knew Bob White there in Livingston, Texas. And he would tell about the story about this man who had been accused of raping a white woman and was tried and ended up being killed by the alleged victim's husband. But the story involved this man who had gone away from Livingston and come back, lived in Houston for a time, had come back to Livingston and was accused of raping a white woman there and was put on trial. Before he was put on trial, the Texas Rangers would periodically take him out of the jail cell and take him and tie him to a tree and beat him. And they did this until he confessed to the rape, and he was sentenced to death, back when you could sentence people to death for raping people, sentenced to the electric chair. His lawyers fought and appealed, and the case was sent back a couple of times. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which I did not know until I was working on this memoir. Mm-hmm. I mean, I teach criminal procedure at the law school, and here's a case, you know, that I had heard about since I was a little girl and didn't know that it went up to the Supreme Court. But in any event, the court sends it down saying that tying somebody to a tree, whipping them until they confess, was a violation of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Surprise, surprise. and they sent it back down for a retrial. And while he was on trial, the husband of the alleged victim, Ruby Cochran, came into the courthouse and shot him in the back of the head in front of the jury, in front of all the spectators, the judge, everybody, hands, you know, the prosecutor, someone the gun. And he's tried, and the case lasts like 5 days later, something like that. The, you know, they deliberate for 2 minutes and acquit him. And so here's a person who murdered someone in front of all these witnesses, and the crowd, you know, the crowd cheers when they announce the verdict. And this really just kind of broke people in the community. And I, as I was writing this, I was thinking about the fact that their hopes must have been raised because he kept getting new trials. Mm-hmm. I mean, they, you know, the Texas court system was looking at this. They were saying, you know, this is, there's something wrong here. And it, they make it all up, all the way up to the Supreme Court, and to have it end like that with a guy dead and his assailant walking free. Yeah. Now, the story, and one of the things that I talk about in the book is the story that my grandfather told me was that White and the woman had been having an affair, and he bragged about it, which, you know, was a crazy thing to do in the 1930s as a Black man and white, but he bragged about it, and the husband found out. And this is the story that, so, and one of the things that I, the points that I make is that they're in this world of conflict between Black and white. There are different stories, stories that have, there's sort of an official version of the story, and then there are unofficial versions. And historians, we have to look at this to decide, you know, if you, if I were really look, trying to answer this question, which I was not here, I was just talking about it, you'd have to try to decide, you know, what seems more truthful than not. But the idea that, you know, a white woman could have welcomed the advances of a Black man, that would have been the end of her social life, maybe her life. And so you could understand why her husband or other people, there would have been pressure to say that this was rape as opposed to something else. And that's the story that was told in the Black community. So there was that instance that prompted members of my family just did not like to come to Conroe. Conroe had a, even before this, there was an instance where a man had been burned at the stake alive on Courthouse Square in the middle of Conroe. And it was advertised that this was going to happen. People showed up. It was like a picnic. You know, it's hard for us to imagine that, you know, that people did this, but people brought their kids. You know, so the town had a reputation for being very, very tough racially. The Klan was there as well. So yeah, after June, that's why my father would say the slaves haven't been freed. I mean, mm-hmm. what he was saying is that, you know, this is still a pretty rough place. They had, white Texans had grown accustomed to the social life under slavery, and began as soon after Juneteenth, after Reconstruction, soon after Juneteenth, as a matter of fact, when people were celebrating, there were instances when people who were celebrating what was called Emancipation Day were whipped for celebrating. So if you can think about a very, very tense time, a time of hope, but at the same time, a lot of recrimination and a lot of hostility on the other side. It was a very, very volatile place.
Yeah. And I can't help but think, as I'm hearing you recount these stories, that while, you know, we're certainly not in Jim Crow anymore, you know, a quick glance at the newspaper or the evening news will show you that, you know, to your father's point, the slaves have not been freed, that we're still seeing, you know, mm-hmm. police brutality. We're still seeing so many vestiges of that today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't, I want to be clear, we're not, back to what I was saying before about the fear of having your children sold away from you, right. Whipping, those kinds of things. But the legacies of slavery, it's very, very difficult to, it's impossible to think of getting rid of all of that in a manner of a few decades. And certainly General Gordon Granger's General Order 3 that says, essentially, doesn't just say slavery is over, he says that blacks and whites will now exist on a, will occupy an equal station, something like that, I'm paraphrasing, but he used the word equality. And that really set people off. I mean, it would be one thing to just say, well, the slaves are freed and, you know, you guys do what you wish, but to say now they're going to be equal really was a like a red flag to people who had been used to a racial hierarchy. I mean, the thing that people talk a lot about, and I write a lot about slavery, but slavery was racially based in the country. So it told people, you know, how blacks and whites should relate to one another. And that, even when you get rid of the legal institution of slavery, it doesn't wipe that out. It doesn't wipe away that social understanding.
Yeah.
And people kept trying to get us back to the point where it was as near to slavery as it could be, controlled in other kinds of ways than the law and that they had existed before before General Granger's order and before, as you said, the final ratification of the 13th Amendment in 1865, December 1865.
I want to fast forward to later in the 20th century when you, at the tender age of six, mm-hmm. integrated the so-called white school in your town. And that was at a time when Texas was trying hard to hold on to segregation in schools in spite of Brown versus Board of Education. Tell us about that experience. I mean, I'm thinking about Ruby Bridges over my shoulder here and thinking about you at age six.
I just noticed that. That's school. That's cool.
What was that experience like as a six-year-old?
It was intense. It was very intense. I knew something that I was doing, something that was considered to be momentous. This was the 60s, but a lot of this was happening all around us. I mean, it was sort of a, there was a feeling in the air that Black people were on the move. They were doing things. And I had a vague sense that I was doing something too, that my family was doing something too. They had this freedom of choice plan under which white parents were supposed to send their kids to the white school and Black parents would send their kids to the Black school. My mother was an English teacher and she taught at the Black school. And she and my father decided, because they figured that the court would strike down the freedom of choice plan, which they did 3 years later, that I should, since I was starting school in earnest, I'd gone to kindergarten at the Black school, that I would start first grade at a white school. And that, you know, put me on a path that was interesting to say the least, but very, very intense. My teachers were wonderful to me. My first grade teacher and second grade people, they were just great. And when I was working on the book, it occurred to me for the first time, all of this stuff you don't think about until you're actually forced to think about it, that maybe it was because my mother was a teacher. I wonder if that, if there was not sort of a professional courtesy, a professional, you know, affinity, which made them go out of their way to be as supportive of me as they could. The kids, some of the kids were not so great. I learned later on there had been threats against my family, but of course they wouldn't have told me anything about that. But it was low key. I wasn't escorted by a marshal. My father took me to school and dropped me off.
Wow.
And just proceeded as if nothing had happened. But of course, something was happening.
Yeah. And Annette, you know, there was certainly the reaction of white people, but also Black people had some mixed reactions to decision.
Yes. Booker T. Washington was the school, and it was K through 12. And it was, you know, members of the community, it was a community thing. The teachers lived in the community. They were sometimes relatives of the kids. They were part of a unified place. And there was some thinking that, well, my mother, what was my mother and father saying about the black school if they would send me to the white school. Now, my two older brothers remained in the black school. So they weren't making a comment about the school, you know, that, you know, there was any problem with the school. They thought that they were doing something, and they kind of backed off from this late in later years. But everything points to them thinking of being idealistic, thinking that this was part of the new world and that I was going to be a part of that new world, help making that new world. So I don't think it was not about the quality of Washington School. It was about what they thought would be the future of the country.
Yeah. I would love for you to read a passage from the book. We talked about this just before we started our formal interview. Okay. And this takes us back to that time when you were 6 years old and you were integrating first grade at that school. So if you wouldn't mind reading that passage, it'll give our audience a flavor for the book in your own voice.
Okay. There was the oddity of being on display. Periodically, small groups of visitors, educators, I assume, would show up and stand in the doorway of the classroom to observe how things were going. A black child in a room with maybe 25 other white students. Not to take anything away from the teachers and administrators at Anderson, but I did make things easy for them. First, and perhaps most important of all, there was for a time only me. One black child was not exactly an invasion. The degree of racial tolerance among whites has always been about numbers. Also, I was a good student right off the bat. In those days when people cared less about making children feel bad, I was a bluebird, the group of the best readers. There was no attempt to hide what was going on from the slower reading birds. We got letter grades in our subjects, and the local newspaper printed the names of kids who were on the honor roll, and my name appeared there. My great-great aunt, the one who would not stay overnight in Conroe, who lived in Houston and was also quite extravagant, bought boxes and boxes of dresses, tights, blouses, skirts, and hats from the most upscale department store in the city at the time, Sackowitz. I remember opening them with my mother and being overwhelmed at the number and range of choices. I could go a long time without repeating an outfit. What it must have meant for my aunt, born on a farm into the even more racially repressive and violent society Texas was at the end of the 19th century, to be present at this moment when one of her young relatives was about to embark upon an adventure in this brave new world. Making sure I was dressed to the nines was her contribution to the civil rights movement.
Thank you so much. I think that gives us a flavor of the time. And I just thought that was such a lovely story about what your great, great aunt did for you and her contribution for such a momentous occasion. I have so many questions that I want to ask you here. One more thing about school, and then I want to fast forward a little bit more. But that you write about how you became at that time something of a symbol to white people, at least to some, about what they felt they were losing at that time, even if you weren't quite aware of it or didn't have the language for it at that point in your life. What was it that they felt they were losing?
Mm-hmm. Well, whites and blacks felt the loss. Whites felt the loss of power, of a sense that they had a special domain in the world. If black people had the same rights as white people, then what did it mean to be white? And what was the benefit of being white if you did not have people below you? And I'm not the first person to say this, but people have observed over the years that the South, the upper classes, wealthy people, the powerful people in the South, sort of stifled class resentment by, you know, talking race, essentially, by telling poor white people, you may be poor, you may not have a future, but at least you're not black. Mm-hmm. And that was something that they held on to. And it prevented, in many cases, solidarity among people who had interests that were quite similar, as a matter of fact. So once you began to see black people getting equal rights, white people felt that they were some white people felt that they were losing ground just by virtue of us having rights, whether we did anything affirmatively to them or not. It took away this notion of the privilege of whiteness. And Black people felt a loss because, as I mentioned about this Booker T. Washington, they lost their school. They lost their teachers because they took most of the Black teachers out of the classroom. My mother remained in the classroom, but lots of other teachers were taken out of the classroom, and they lost that special bond that they had with between teachers and students. I mean, both people felt that they knew something was changing. They understood that change was coming, but I think both groups felt that that something was lost in this process.
Yeah, I could talk to you all evening about that period in your life, but I want to fast forward so we can get to our audience questions. You also write about how Texas has been something of a bellwether for where the United States is going and what it will become. And from a political standpoint, most of us who are outside of Texas have observed it to be reliably red. And yet in the last election, and maybe the last few, we've seen that Texas is developing what some folks call a blue spine, right? This democratic sort of area along I-35 that roughly cuts the state in half. And Joe Biden did pretty well in Texas, though he did not win the state. And I wonder what you think about what all of that means for where Texas is headed and where the United States is headed politically.
Mm-hmm. Well, the phrase that people have used, the word that people have used is Texification, that America is becoming like Texas. But my original point that we talked about before is that it's always kind of been like America. It's just that because of this sort of weird outsized image, people see it as not like America, but it really kind of is. Yes, politically, Texas has been changing. Although there's a saying that Texas is not so much a red state as it is a voter suppressed state, that if people were allowed to vote, if people would come out to vote, and then if people were allowed to come out to vote in numbers, that it could probably turn it purple, at least. We don't know. It depends on what happens with all these laws that are now being put in place because of the greater voter participation, particularly in cities. So we'll see. The prediction that it's going to go one way or the other is really hard to make, because we have to know whether there will be voting rights, mandated voted rights, they will be protected or not, because there's been a reaction to the greater voter participation in these efforts. And it just depends on what those suppression efforts, what they yield, whether they will be stopped.
That was actually my next question. And I'm curious, as an historian, as you're watching all of this play out in so many states across the country now, these restrictive laws that are trying to be put into place, how you're thinking about that, decades after the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and here we are. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking as you're watching all of this unfold?
Well, I'm thinking with a bit of alarm. I'm thinking even the Voting Rights Act, of course, but even as a scholar of the early American Republic, you think about the promise of, democratic republicanism, the idea that people would be the rulers, and you have to do that by voting, having the opportunity to vote, and the notion that eligible voters would be in any way hindered. You should want more voting, not less voting. And that's part of what a Republican society is supposed to be. But the construction of republicanism, and when I mean this with a small r, a representative government, for some people is about whites. It's not about the Republican values, Republican spirit, so forth, applying to all people. So yeah, it's alarming to me thinking about the Voting Rights Act. It's alarming to me as a scholar who studies early America and what the founders and what the original notions of the country and what, I guess, the promise that was realized after the Civil War, with the amendments that were put in place, what that was supposed to portend. And that was a state, a country where people had the right to participate in governance and to decide who governs them.
One more question before we go to our audience, and I want to quote you here. You're right. There is no question that violence has been at the heart of the Texas story, or should I say violence has been foregrounded in the origin stories of Texas in ways it is not in other states. Certainly, as we've discussed, plenty of that violence has been directed against people of color, and yet there is such a pride, particularly for Texans, as we discussed early on in our conversation. And I'm wondering, as a Texan, as an African-American, how you thread that needle and how you would advise other African-Americans, wherever they might live in the United States, to sort of hold that tension between remembering an oppressive history and taking pride in the place that they call home.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes to me through my family. And, you know, I end the book talking about the fact that these were my formative, this Texas is where my formative associations were made. And I love the state through the experiences that I had there with my mother and my father and my brothers and my friends growing up and becoming who I am in this spot. And, you know, being fortunate to have, you know, parents who loved me and an extended family whom I loved and were supportive of me. In this place, we made a world for ourselves in this place. And that is sort of the basis of how I view Texas as a whole. I like the idea of the wide open spaces. I like the idea of the spirit. I've written that, you know, I feel freest when I'm on a highway riding in Texas, playing the music really loud. I like the sense of the outsizedness of it, but it comes through family and it comes through experiences and it comes through a hard-worn, you know, hard-fought battle for equality among that my great-grandfather, I found my great-great-grandfather's voter registration on a list from 1867. This is a participation, a will to participate and to be a part, thwarted in many ways, but the will was there. And that's the thing that sustains me in thinking about the state.
Yeah. Well, since you mentioned family, we'll start with this question from Bonnie, who says, since you have shared so much of your family in this book, have you ever searched your roots, especially the origins of the name Gordon?
Well, I'm assuming, you know, I know my father's family. Every African-American people typically hit the 1870 wall because the census reports, that's when they first show up enslaved people show up on census records. And I have not traced slave owners or so forth. I'm assuming the name Gordon may have been from a family of people who owned my relatives, or they may have chosen it. It's not the case that all enslaved people took the names of their enslavers. Sometimes they just picked the name because they liked it. So I don't know. I have not searched that. I know back pretty far on both sides, but I haven't done the kind of research that I've done about the Hemings family and Jefferson's family and the family of my historical subjects. But that's something that I want to do now. I know great, great, great grandparents and things like that, but not about their lives, about what they were doing. And I'd like to find out more about that.
Well, we have another question here about family. Steve asks, Attica Locke has written novels set in East Texas about a Black family which came out of Reconstruction owning some property and reveals how much of a difference this made generations later. Was this true of any of your family in Texas? If so, how did they manage to achieve this? And what difference did it make in your own life?
Well, I think that there's something to that on both sides of my family. My father's great-great-grandfather came out of slavery and he and his brothers saved their money. They worked and saved their money and they bought a number of acres of land, a couple of hundred acres of land, and they cut and sold timber off of it. They were big guys and they were basically lumberjacks. So yeah, and we still have some of that property. I mean, some of it has been sold off, but we sold timber from it. And we still, in recent years, have sold timber from it. So that gave them a measure of protection. They had something, they had their own land and they had their own capacity to take care of themselves. on my mother's side, my great-great-grandmother, they had a cotton farm. And so they, my great-grandfather, when after, you know, planting, he would go to Galveston and work on the wharves because he could make more. He hired a couple of people to work on the farm, but he could still make more money going there to work and then paying people to help my grandmother and my great-grandmother and his daughters. The sons had died than if he sort of stayed there. So I think property ownership matters. I think that's one reason, perhaps the reason my family did not leave the South, because they didn't want to leave land behind. I've often wondered about that. Why didn't you go? I mean, this is really rough places. As I said, Conroe was rough and Livingston was not much better than that, but they stayed. And I'm thinking that it could be because they didn't want to leave their land. I don't know that for a fact, but that's a supposition.
Yeah. Question from Valerie. She says, thank you so much for your memoir, Professor Gordon Reed. I have two questions. One, what do you think motivated the legislature to make Juneteenth a holiday in 1979-80? That's the first question. And the second is, how do you understand General Granger's decision to use the term equality in the order?
Mm-hmm. Well, on the first question, agitation. Black Texans, legislators, they pushed for it. And Texans pushed for it. And I think that there was a time when there was at least a movement towards some notion of racial reconciliation. I mean, doing things that suggested that Texas was a more inclusive place. And I talk a little bit about this in the book, much more so than when I was a little girl. So it was agitation by Blacks and legislators who wanted to push this, and whites who wanted to be conciliatory about this. It's something that it was a celebration. It was something that reflected well on Texas, not the backlash part, but the fact that this thing had happened there. So I think it was a sort of a combined effort. And on the question of...
Let me go back. Okay, so it was General Granger.
Oh, yes, equality.
Yes.
You know, I read his biography and his biographer thinks that he thought that was an important thing to do, that he understood that this was going to be a part of a transformation of the South. That's what many of the people in the North thought had to happen, that it wasn't just enough to free people. You had to understand that now they were going to be a part of society. So it was just you attach significance to the fact that some scholars attach significance to the fact that it's the first thing he did when he got there. He right away has this order. He could have, I mean, there were other stuff to do, but he did that and put it out. And there's some questions about how it was announced. Some people say that he stood on a balcony and announced it. Other people say that his troops went through the city of Galveston and told people. It was probably both, could have been both, but he thought it was an important thing to do to sort of establish that this was going to be a new society.
Yeah. Susan asks, can you speak to the issue of reparations?
Mm-hmm. Speak to the issue of reparations. I think the issue, well, it's a moral issue and there's a moral right to this idea. I personally think as a lawyer, this is the lawyer in me, that if I were doing this, I would start in the 20th century, I would start with activities by the government, redlining for housing, failing to protect Black homeowners that has resulted in disparate wealth, a sort of a gap in the wealth between Blacks and whites. Start with people who are alive, who are still alive, who suffered wrongs after the passage of the 14th Amendment and clearly illegal activities. And violations of the Constitution, I would start with that kind of reparations. Reparations for slavery are a sore point, and not to say, again, as I said, there's a moral right to it, but me being the lawyer and being pragmatic, I would start with the 20th century violations of civil rights and of the Constitution among plaintiffs for whom we have standing, that is to say, people who can point specifically to how they've been injured. And I would start there. And then maybe we could work our way back to it. I would not start with slavery, I would start with 20th century violations of the Constitution.
Speaking of working our way back, Krista has a question that says, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about the lasting impacts of slavery?
Well, the biggest misconception is, I think, is that it's that they're not there, that the impacts are not there. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts in voting rights case in Shelby County basically said that the South has changed. All of this is over, essentially. And how wrong he was. The biggest misconception is that you can walk out of a couple of centuries of a society, of a particular attitudes, a particular culture, and then have it done. I mean, it's really not until 1965, with the Voting Rights Act, that we have what could be considered a legally equal free society. That's not a long time at all. This has been a short amount of time that we've been doing this. And as we can see from the things that are happening today, it's happening in fits and starts, right? I mean, it's two steps forward, three steps back. So I think the big misconception is that you can just cut this stuff off and now we're in a new day. This is something that we have to work at. We have to acknowledge that and work at to make a different culture that's removed from the society that was created by chattel slavery.
A question from Bonnie, and this is something that you write about in the book. She asks, can you explain the Yellow Rose of Texas?
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. Can I explain it? No, I actually can't. But no, I don't know what that's about. You know, that's a story that I did not hear growing up. The first time I heard about this as something that was supposed to be about race and Texas history was in the 90s when I came back to visit with my kids. Yellow Rose of Texas is a song that's pretty, if you look at the original lyrics, it's pretty obviously about a Black woman. A mixed race Black woman, a yellow girl. There's a yellow girl in Texas. They changed it to Rose. That there was another lyric that talked about Rose, but to remove the racial part of it, they made it into the Yellow Rose of Texas as the throughout all of the lyrics. And I knew the song, obviously, and thought it was sort of an interesting song, but it was written, it was a minstrel kind of show song. Mm-hmm. That was written about a Black woman, but it has a Black man in dialect singing about this yellow gal in Texas that he's going to see. And now there was a story that arose that this grew out of the story of Emily West, who was a woman who lived in who was from New York, who moved down to Texas as a servant with a white man, not as a slave. She wasn't enslaved. And the story, the kind of, I don't want to use the word romantic story, but the story is that she and Santa Anna, when we're about to go into battle, she occupied Santa Anna and he wasn't ready for battle. And so she has been sort of spun as a Texas heroine in a way. But the real Emily West was taken, apparently the evidence indicates she was taken hostage by the Mexican army. But the notion that she had some kind of affair with Santa Anna, much less that she did it, some people say the legend is at the behest of Sam Houston himself to occupy Santa Anna so he would be distracted from battle. That is apparently apocryphal story, but I think it's fascinating. What work is this doing? And this is an example of trying to bring African-Americans into the story of Texas and the Texas Republic. But of course it's not a great fit because the Republic did not allow Black people to immigrate there. And it was a republic that supported slavery. So you got to wonder, why would she have wanted to be an agent for Sam Houston to bring about the Texas Republic? But in a twisted, strange kind of way, it's a sign of wanting to make Black people a part of the sort of grand mythology of Texas. And it's somewhat misplaced, but I understand the impetus for it.
It's like the Black Confederate soldier.
Yeah, right? You know, there were legions of, you know, Black Confederate soldiers, not people who were sort of, you know, made to come to these things.
Question from Megan, who says, given your ties to Livingston, I'm curious if you can give any insight into the treatment of the Alabama Coushatta, which is one of three officially recognized Native tribes in Texas, in comparison to how African Americans were treated in the same small town while you were growing up. Specifically, was there any type of community or shared struggle, or did the two communities actively try to stay separated? Were the African-American and Native communities treated the same by the power structure of the town, or did the different groups have different types of discrimination / issues?
Well, you know, I was born about 17 miles from the Alabama Coushatta Indian Reservation. We used to go visit there. I have a chapter about this in the book, talking about the sort of mania and the sort of romanticization of Native Americans in the 70s. You know, that was the thing to sort of do, not treating them as with as much respect as, you know, making them symbols of things. So, you know, I can't answer all of that, all of those questions. My connection to the Alabama Coushatta group nation was essentially going to visit the reservation periodically with cousins and watching, you know, the sort of cultural things that they did and buying their, you know, Native American artifacts and jewelry and so forth. I haven't been there in many years. I gather now it's a much bigger operation than it was then. There's a casino, it's gaming, they're doing gaming. They weren't doing that then. It was more of a campground, and you went there and you had picnics and you learned about their culture and the two nations that had become, you know, one together. I think that they pretty much stayed separate because they were on their reservation and Black people were in their on the Black side of town in Livingston. I don't know any stories of cooperation or whatever, but they kept pretty much to themselves as far as I know, because they had their own land and they had their own way of life. And I talk in the book about my father, who himself romanticized Native Americans and thought that there should be and was some connection between the two of them because of their shared history with white people. But I don't know that that was the case with Alabama Coushatta and Black people in Livingston.
Deborah says, Professor Gordon Reed, how do you see more Black history being taught in public schools? It seems as if few history classes are devoted to teaching Black history as part of the American experience.
Well, you know, I think it's gotten better. I mean, it could always get better than it is, but I think that there's so much more than when I was growing up. And there are, you know, organizations like Gilda Lehrman who have programs for teachers and, you know, lesson plans, all those kinds of things. I think that this is a moment where, I know not everybody's open to this, but there's a real hunger, I think, for having conversations about race. Certainly much more so than when I was growing up many years ago. So I'm relatively hopeful about this. I think there's more to come and there are more things available than ever at this point. And if, you know, I know teachers are under a lot of pressure to teach to tests and in certain ways, but to the extent that they have any freedom at all, there's a lot of material out there for this because there's a hunger for it.
Yeah. Brian asks, how can Juneteenth be appropriately celebrated and remembered by white people today?
Barbecue? Firecrackers?
Red soda water.
No, I mean, the same way Black people do. The same way too. It's, as I said, it's about paying respects to people who went through a lot and recognizing their joy, understanding that there's still a long way to go, and maybe committing yourself in whatever way you can to be part of that process of making things better in whatever way you can. Mm-hmm. So we're human beings. We celebrate the way human beings do things. We eat, we get to gather with our family, we have fun. And it's, as I said, this is a July 4th type thing, but now it's for Black and white.
Yeah. Ronnie asks, will the book be available in audio format?
It is available in audio format. Okay. I haven't listened to it yet, but it is there.
Did you do the narration or someone else?
No, I did not. They had a professional person do it.
But it is available.
Yes, it's available.
Well, we've got a question here from Christiana who says, you mentioned the image of Texas earlier. What does the image of Texas look like now in relation to race and or other issues?
Wow, this is an interesting time for the book to be coming out. It's not a great image, I have to say. The grid failure, the voter suppression measures, those kinds of things. You know, it's looking pretty bleak in some ways, but there's a response to this. I from everything I've read, people in Texas, Black people in Texas, white people in Texas who want a better Texas are committed to standing tall against these things. And so I'm hopeful now that attention has been paid to that, that we're gonna fight it. They're gonna fight it out and see, you know, try to see what they can do to make sure that the progress that has been made on the racial front continues to be made.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great note to end on. And just before we go, I just wanted to read a couple of things here from our audience. Martha says, thank you for your words. Deborah says, thank you so much, Professor Annette Gordon-Reed, for your inspiring scholarship and the Free Library of Philadelphia for hosting. It was so nice to hear your story and get a preview of your book in your own words. Looking forward to reading it. And finally, Nicole, if you look in the question section, anyone who's interested in that Yellow Rose of Texas story, Nicole has placed a link there some further information about that if anyone would like to look into that. So thanks to Nicole for that. Professor Annette Gordon-Reed, it has been an absolute honor and delight to be able to spend time with you tonight. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thanks to our audience for all your great questions and participation. As always, thanks to Andy Cahan and to Laura and Jason, the team at Author Events at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Again, the book is on Juneteenth. You can get it at the Joseph Fox Bookshop. Be sure to get it, enjoy it. Oh, and very quickly, before we go, Professor Gordon-Reed, your next book is?
The Hemings is part deux. I'm not calling it that, but the second part of the Hemings family story in the 19th century.
So we will all look forward to that. Again, thanks everyone for being with us tonight. Have a great night and we'll see you next time. Good night.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.